Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Eric Larson, who reads from and discusses his new book, Thunderstruck, published by Crown. In the weeks to come, we have John Naisbitt, Jeff Shara, Les Claypool, Nick Bantock, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome and thank you so much for coming this evening. It is a pleasure to welcome Eric Larson once again to the Tattered Cover. Mr. Larson has given us several books of narrative history that have captured the attention of both critics and readers. But his first book was The Naked Consumer, about the manipulation of the consumer by corporations eager to have them buy their products. Well, that was followed by Lethal Passage, which traced an individual gun through its ultimately tragic history. Isaac Storm followed, and it hit like a tidal wave. I couldn't help that. Which is appropriate, as it is the story of the devastating hurricane that nearly wiped out Galveston, Texas, and became a must-read last year as readers saw firsthand the effects of a gigantic storm on a city. Devil in the White City took a slightly different turn, as it was about the marvel that was the World's Fair in Chicago, juxtaposed on the examination of a serial killer that terrorized the city at that time. His new book also has two forces of good and evil, as he recounts the circumstances of the birth of wireless communication and its inventor, Marconi, and how that incredible invention was used to track and find the notorious killer, Dr. Holly Harvey Crippen. The manhunt for Dr. Crippen mesmerized the public, but as fascinating as that part of the story is, it is in the use of new technology which awed and intrigued people of the Edwardian age. And one can find parallels in our own time, and so we can relate to the wonder wireless communication caused as we watch the development of the computer and the internet. From the first page, the reader is captivated by the individuals and history Mr. Larson so carefully draws with such wonderful detail. And like all good mysteries, fictional or non-fictional, it is a hard book to put down. Please join me in welcoming Eric Larson.
Well, thank you very much. It is really very nice to be back here. I don't know how, not back to this store. Of course, this is quite new and quite nice, but I've been back to the, been to the Tattered Cover I don't know how many times now. And I spent actually a lovely day today in Denver. I went to the art museum. Damn, I love it. My middle daughter is a real art junkie, so I had to call her from the museum and just tell her that you know, and the campaign is called Give a Damn. I just love it. I also went to the Central Public Library, and that's the building that I love. I went up to the fifth floor, you know, there. That's a stunning building. We have a brand new public library also in Seattle, but I think I'd rather have the Michael Graves building. I have to say that now going around with my books and giving bookstore talks, it's so much more gratifying than it was with that first book of mine, The Naked Consumer. And I think any writer will tell you that bookstore talks can often be rather problematic. But first I'd like to sort of find out exactly how well The Naked Consumer did. So all those of you who read it, could you please stand? It is, in fact, a book that nobody bought. Nobody read. One guy reviewed, but he was a target of the book. And he hated the book. He hated it. However, I was living in Baltimore at the time, and I did get invited to do one book talk. It wasn't a talk. It was a book event. And I thought, okay, I'm on my way now. This is the start of something really good. So I drove up from Baltimore to Lancaster. It's about a 3-hour drive. It was a Sunday afternoon. this should have been my first warning. It was the first nice Sunday in the dead of winter in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It was like 70 degrees and sunny, and the snow was piled in drifts like up to here, you know. So anyway, so I show up at this very, very large, not independent bookstore, and I'm put way at the back of the store at a table. You've seen these things, I think, with about 40 books piled up, right? Some lonely-looking guy just sitting there at a table. And I was booked in for about 3 hours. I sat there at this table. Somebody mercifully made a plate of chocolate chip cookies and put them on the table beside me, because God knew nobody was going to buy this book unless there were cookies. So I sat there, and literally, I mean, people would walk. It was as if I were here. People would walk and look at the books all around me, but never engage me, never make eye contact with me. It was as if I was some kind of class 3 sex offender paroled to the bookstore, you know. Johnny, don't go near that man. So I sat there literally for an hour and a half before anybody came and even talked to me. And at about the hour and a half point, I looked up, and this woman was coming towards me just with the biggest smile on her face. So I'm taking out my pen, and I'm ready to sign books, you know. I'm thinking, now is the time that starts, you know. She comes up to the table and she says, "How much are the cookies?" So being a writer is a perpetual humiliation, actually. I have to share with you a story that involves a very famous female novelist, but I'll keep her name out if maybe she doesn't want it known. But she was giving a talk, presumably early in her career, but maybe not. She was giving a talk at a bookstore, and there were 4 people in the audience. And so she was doing her reading, and she became aware of cops on both sides of the room. She continues to read. The cops move in and bust 2 members of the audience. 50% of her audience is arrested by the police. What was their excuse for being in the bookstore? They wanted to lose themselves in the crowd. One last story. How many of you have read Memoirs of a Geisha? So you know roughly what hemisphere it takes place in, correct? Well, one of the things that we writers like to do, I swear to God, I have never, ever, ever done this, but one of the things we like to do is we like to go into a bookstore, and again, I've never done this, we like to go into a bookstore and we like to, without identifying ourselves, say, if I had done this, I would do something like this. I would say, "So, do you have this great book, Thunderstruck, by this terrific writer, Eric Larson?" Without identifying myself, of course, as the author. And if they say yes, then all is fine. If they say no, then you sort of whip off your cape and say, "Ah, I'm the author. Why don't you have the book?" It's something actually we all do. But again, I never have. But Arthur Golden, who is the author of Memoirs of a Geisha, was not above doing so, and he went into one particularly benighted store in the Deep South, the only store in the South. Stop. I have to stop that. I'm kidding. Actually, there's some lovely stores in the South. But anyway, so he goes into this particularly kind of benighted store, and he asks, "Do you have a copy of this great book, Memoirs of a Geisha?" There's this furious clicking at the information desk, and the woman there says, "Well, as a matter of fact, we do. We have one copy. It's in Jewish studies." So this poor guy, I don't know how he gets home, but he gets home, and I don't know why. See, he hasn't written anything else since, and I think that's the reason. He gets home, and he tells his wife, and his wife, I think, gets it absolutely right. She says, "Oh my God, they thought it was Memoirs of a Geisha." So I thought I'd talk briefly tonight about Thunderstruck, my new book. Talk a little bit about my goals in writing a book like this, and writing my books that the last 3 books are sort of, people like to describe it as narrative nonfiction. I don't really know what to call it. It is what it is, but it's awfully fun to do, and I hope kind of fun to read. And I thought I would take some questions. That's my favorite part of the thing. You can ask me questions about any of the books, especially the Naked Consumer. You know, it's near to my heart. I have to be a little careful about talking about Thunderstruck because it is kind of a mystery. I mean, it's a true story, but it's kind of a mystery. I mean, there are things that I don't really want to give away. But I thought first broadly, I'll just tell you what the book is about. It's about the lives of two men and how those lives converge in what I consider to be the greatest criminal chase in history. And I think I'm right. Certainly eclipses the OJ thing, you know, at least by another 10 days, although frankly it seemed to me that the OJ thing lasted 10 days. One of the characters is an inventor, and that's Marconi, who is often described as the inventor of radio. I'm very careful about the word inventor, though, in the case of Marconi. I prefer to say that he's the guy who turned wireless into a practical means of communication against tremendous opposition and tremendous odds. The other narrative, this is a two narratives, although in this case they actually do converge. The other is a murderer, Hawley Harvey Crippen, who is in fact the second most famous murderer in British history. The first being Jack, Saucy Jack. Alfred Hitchcock was so entranced with the Crippen case that he lifted elements of it for a number of his films and TV shows, including Rear Window. And if you were to buy this book, and you're under no obligation to do so, just mind the electrodes in the chairs. You're under no obligation to do so, obviously. But if you do, and then rent Rear Window, because there is this great brief monologue in which Jimmy Stewart sort of summarizes a very critical aspect of the case in the very as only Jimmy Stewart possibly could. Now, I swear that I did not set out initially to do another dual narrative, let alone another dual narrative with murder. In fact, after I finished Devil in the White City, the final draft, that is, and my wife will attest to this, I was running around my house saying, there is no way in hell that I'm going to do another dual narrative because it's just too hard. And now it's like writing two books instead of one book and then starting to write an extra half a book by trying to piece them both together into a single coherent narrative. In fact, I had really wanted to do something very small and kind of gentle, a straight-line narrative. I had an idea that actually dated to the 18th century. It was going to be a little itty-bitty book, sort of along the lines of like a Mitch Albom book or a Nicholas Sparks book, you know, one of those little things that you can read on the John in one sitting, you know. Forgive me. So one day I was sitting in my office. I had discarded a dozen ideas. You know, there was the 18th century idea, several in World War II, ideas all over the place. And for some reason, it occurred to me that maybe there was something in the history of wireless. Why not? Wireless was absolutely ubiquitous today. How interesting to find out what the origins were. You know, I mean, we have wireless. We have cell phones. We have wireless on our computers. We have cars with GPS systems, and you can choose the accent, you know, whether it's American English or British English. Have you seen the latest system in Toyota? It's fascinating. Turn right, please. My media escort in Chicago had one. It was really a kick. We plugged in the Mustang Ranch in Nevada. We didn't get anything. It didn't come up. So somebody's thinking. Anyway, I started thinking about wireless. Did what any self-respecting writer does these days. I Googled it, Googled wireless, came up with half a billion websites, most of them garbage. But there was one that was really, really very interesting. It was called MarconiCalling.com. And anybody who has an interest in radio or Marconi can just, you know, go ahead and dig in. It's a very, very nice website. It's a very good website for the reason that a lot of the materials on the website are live things. Like you have photographs of newspaper clippings. You have photographs of letters. You have photographs of live documents. So it's not something that some summer intern typed in with the wrong dates, you know, which, by the way, is something I encountered on Devil in the White City on the website of the Chicago Historical Society. That was a very interesting experience. But anyway, so I Googled wireless, found this Marconi Calling website, and I was going through it, kind of reading aimlessly, and then I came across in the directory for the website the name Crippen. And I knew the name from when I was a kid back in the 1960s, and I remembered that when I first heard about this case, I heard about it from my mother. It's one of those funky little childhood memories, you know, those things that just like, boom, you're right there. I can tell you where I was in my house when my mother told me about the Crippen case. Now, she was not alive at the time of the Crippen case, but she was a mystery junkie. She had written a variety of mystery short stories, some of which have been published. And I think what happened is that back in the 1960s, well, I know that back in the 1960s, a key character in the book died, and I think that might have been the trigger, because that must have been about the time when she told me about this. But all I had in my mind was this recollection of kind of romance and also something fairly kind of macabre and kind of spooky, which, of course, to a boy was great stuff. That's probably why it impressed me. I was a big Alfred Hitchcock junkie. I read all those collections of short stories, watched The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits and all that stuff. So here it is in this wireless website. Here's this reference to Crippen. And I just couldn't... What in the world is this killer doing in a wireless website? So I started reading more, and I came across this amazing chase involving a couple of ocean liners, and I don't want to go into too many details, but it was just great, lasting 11 days. And that was really the trigger for me. I was like, wow, this is just sort of another example of Gilded Age hubris and charm, which is, I think, why these books, my last three books, have been done roughly in the same period. It's not like I set out to do something from 1890 to 1910 in that period. It's just that, I don't know, there's just something so charming and powerful about a time when people thought they could do absolutely anything and then set out to do it and often actually succeeded. I don't consider myself a historian, and in fact a lot of historians don't consider me a historian, I can assure you. I don't consider myself a historian. What I mean by that is I don't consider myself a historian in the traditional academic sense. I mean, unfortunately, professional historians, academic historians, often have to hew to a certain agenda. You know, like when I did Devil in the White City, I mean, I was in it for the story. I didn't want to do a Marxist deconstruction of, you know, the manufacturer's building or anything like that. I think of myself rather as an animator of history. My goal with my books is that you will begin reading the book and you will sink into the past and ideally not emerge until the end of the book, and emerge having feeling as if you have experienced another life for the period that you were reading the book. My favorite reaction to Devil in the White City was from a woman in Chicago after I'd given a talk at the Arts Club. And she stood up, and I swear she was near tears, and she said, "You know, I finished your book, and I didn't want to come back." Because I didn't know where she'd really been, but I like that reaction. I think that's exactly what I'm after. I have to emphasize that it is not about making it up. It's not about making it up, though I have been accused of that on national television by my own daughter, my middle daughter Lauren, when she was 9 years old. This is back when Isaac Storm was just out. She was 9. I was invited down to the big Texas book fair, which at the time was thrown by Laura Bush. This is before she became First Lady and before George Bush became Julius Caesar. But, you know, she was, I apologize, you know. But anyway, we went down to the Texas book fair, and Laura Bush was great. She's a very warm, very, 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 very sweet woman, and she was really totally into literature, and she is still to this day. So we go down there, and Lauren reads my book, Isaac Storm, on the plane, burning corpses and all. She's a very precocious kid. She reads it on the plane down, and we get there, check in, go to the conference. We're shown into the State House auditorium where we're going to give the I'm going to give the talk. Place is packed. Laura Bush is there. Barbara Bush is there. Secret Service is there. Television cameras are there. It's just great. Texans love their history. It was just the most satisfying thing to walk into that room. So I park my 9-year-old in a space that's allotted for her. I tell her, look, just don't do anything. After I'm done, we're going to go back to the hotel, and we're going to swim in the pool. And so, you know where this is going. So I gave the talk, really a lot of fun, start answering questions. I see this little hand go up in the corner. And I'm inclined to ignore it, but the cameraman is not. The C-SPAN camera swivels. It was focused on her. The guy with the microphone, the little fuzzy microphone, comes right up, holds it in front of her face. She stands. I say, "Yes, Lauren." She says, "Dad, how much of this did you make up?" To this day, I don't know how she got back to Seattle. But I'm kind of glad she did, although she is 16, so I say that with qualification. No, she's a great kid most of the time, some of the time. But it's not about making it up. It's about detail. It's about finding the right bits and pieces of detail that will just sort of ignite something in the imagination and then let the mind of the reader put stuff together so that these books read like fiction, although they definitely are not fiction. One teeny example from Thunderstruck, the kind of thing that this will give you a sense of how excruciatingly boring my life must be, but I can spend an entire day in an archive. I mean, in the case of, you know, Devil in the White City, I found that the guy who originated this really novel ambulance service was named Dr. Gentles, you know? In the case of Thunderstruck, one of the witnesses interviewed by Scotland Yard after the cataclysmic events unfolded in this book, one of the witnesses was named May Pole. May Pole. Got to be a hooker. That's my feeling. But I mean, can you imagine going through life as May Pole? That's one little teeny detail. I love finding little things like that. In this case, finding the detail really proved to be an adventure. I mean, I really felt like I was the Indiana Jones of historical research. I had to go all over the place. I had to go to Rome. I had to go to London. I had to go to Munich, Bologna. I had to go to Ottawa, Nova Scotia, Cape Cod. I mean, I could have gone other places, but I was running out of money and also running out of time. But some of the things I found along the way. First of all, I came back from these trips always with, especially the trips to Britain, always with a renewed appreciation of American libraries. I mean, you can walk into an American library and do whatever you want, and nobody's going to stop you until the cops come, you know. I mean, like walking into the Central Public Library today, I mean, just walked right in, nobody even paid any attention to me, you know. It was just great. Not so with British libraries. British libraries have a very different attitude about research. They're sort of exclusive. I have yet to go to the British Library because the British Library bills itself as the library of last resort. And they mean it. They mean it. You have to prove to the British Library that you have expended every other library before they will give you admission. You have to prove it to them that you have gone to this place, this place, and this place, and this place. So I never got to the British Library. I finally wound up at... I also went to Oxford, and that was really a nice experience. But there, too, I had learned my lesson from the British Library, so a month before I called to make sure that I could actually get into the library, and they said, "Well, yeah, certainly you can, but first you need to have somebody fill out for you a recommender form." I had to have somebody vouch for me. I mean, I hadn't had to have that since I was 12, you know, a parent permission slip. So I found, at first I called up. I wanted to make sure I understood this so that there was no misunderstanding by the time I arrived. And I said, "Well, can I just use a neighbor? She's an academic." He said, "No. It has to be somebody who has a professional relationship with you." So I ultimately settled on an editor in my publishing house. So I sent that along, and I had an appointment to go to Oxford. I show up, and, you know, I was photographed and various other things, checked my passport and so forth, which is not that. I mean, Library of Congress does the same thing. I have to have a reader's card. But then came the interesting part. I had to go to the second desk. And there I had to read aloud a declaration. I had to read aloud a declaration in which I promised not to set anything in the library on fire. I believe the term used was alight. Happily, I had left my blowtorch at home on security, you know. Often when I'm doing books, I mean, always when I'm doing a book, you get so immersed in it. There's nothing supernatural about this, but that you get so immersed in the research that weird little connections occur that just seem kind of bizarre. In the case of Devil in the White City, something really bizarre happened. I don't even think I mentioned it in the book because it was just too implausible. Those of you who did not read the book, first of all, would you stand? Those of you who did not read the book, it's about a serial killer and the guy who built the World's Fair of 1893. The serial killer used the fair as a lure for his victims. And then there's a parallel story of this guy building, Daniel Burnham, building the fair against, again, sort of incredible obstacles, really incredible obstacles. But anyway, when I set out to do that book, I was a couple of months in, I was briefly sort of troubled by bringing something that dark into my house in Seattle, because I'm kind of vaguely a believer in karma, or at least certainly in the concept of what goes around comes around, and then certain extensions from there. And so I was sitting there in my office kind of worrying about this, and my wife, who is a physician scientist, walked in, and I told her my concern, and she gave me a look that I think most of the men in this audience are familiar with, which is this sort of withering disdain, you know, which snapped me out of it completely, and that was fine. Until toward the very end of the research, I decided I really ought to go to the cemetery where Holmes, the killer, was buried. So I drive out there, and what I consider, I used to live in Philadelphia, and I loved Philadelphia, but August is not its most stellar month. And I went out to the cemetery on kind of a gray, hot, humid August day. And it took me a little bit to convince the receptionist that, in fact, this Catholic cemetery had a serial killer buried, you know, in this grave. But after I persuaded her, and after she, in fact, brought out this old binder dating to, like, I think it was 1894, and there in ink we saw the sort of weird requirements of his burial. No gravestone, 10 tons of concrete, two graves instead of merely one. That resonated a bit because of all the talk of a curse involving Holmes, because in fact a lot of the folks who brought him to justice had awful things happen to them after the trial. I think it's purely coincidence, but nonetheless it made for interesting reading. So anyway, I'm there at the cemetery, and she tells me where approximately, how to find this grave. So I set out driving through this cemetery, quite large cemetery. I'm not encouraged by the fact that the first lane that I'm driving along is called Lazarus Lane. You know, I mean, who decided to call that lane in a cemetery Lazarus Lane? I mean, talk about false hope. So I drove out to the approximate location of the grave and found what I think is the spot where the grave was. There was no gravestone, but there were gravestones all around. There was a World War I pilot, various people from the 1890s and the 1900s, and I thought, okay, this seems reasonable. I was kind of standing there, kind of absorbing the terrain, just trying to get a sense of what was there now. And there was a tremendous clap of thunder, single clap, not a rolling thing, just a single boom. And there had been no lightning before, and there was no lightning after that day. And I got the hell out of that cemetery. I got the hell out of it. Only because cemeteries, you know, I mean, you don't want to be out in the cemetery when there's a thunderstorm. Purely my reasoning on that score. But in the case of thunderstruck, another kind of interesting thing happened. I had, and I promise you this story is going somewhere, but I had checked into, in London, I had booked myself into a hotel that did not have air conditioning. It's not uncommon in London. A lot of hotels, a lot of very particularly charming small hotels do not have air conditioning. So I thought, fine. I arrive, heat wave. 80, 90 degrees. 80, 90 degrees in London is excruciating. After two sleepless nights, I resolved, okay, I got to find a new hotel. So I started wandering around Bloomsbury looking for that next hotel, and I stumbled upon a place that I recommend to anybody who goes to London. It's called Academy House. Fantastic, on Gower Street. Terrific, charming place with the nicest people. They had one room available, top floor, rear, blissfully air-conditioned. I snapped it up. It spent a great night. The next morning, I had allotted to finding the addresses that were crucial to this book. Hilldrop Crescent, where the sort of final events occur, places where Marconi worked, and a street called Store Street, which is quite an important address in the book as well. So I started wandering around, and my you know, travels took me back. I started looking for Store Street, and lo and behold, not only was it right in view of my new room at this hotel, but the part of Store Street where these guys live was like right there. It was like somebody was telling me, you're on the right track. It was very interesting. And I really like moments like that, because that does sort of make me feel like I have gone the distance. Now I'm getting the connections. Now I'm getting the payback. It's kind of like putting that last quarter in the slot machine, you know, and getting that huge payoff. It was a very satisfying thing. However, I have to say that my absolute favorite moment came in Rome. First of all, in preparation for doing this book, I thought I would need to know some Italian. I didn't realize then, though, that Marconi conducted most of his affairs, personal and business, in exquisite English. His mother, after all, was Annie Jameson of the Jameson Whiskey Empire. So anyway, I took some Italian. I took it with my eldest daughter. I took it because I felt I had to, and she took it because she wanted to. It was a great experience. Actually, if you ever want to learn humility, take a course with your teenage daughter, especially a language course. I mean, my kid is hardwired for language. We studied it together for about 2.5 years. She's now at Georgetown and is continuing to study it, and she is fluent. She's absolutely fluent. She was quite fluent at the time that we went to Rome. I took her as my, just for that trip, as kind of my research assistant, at least as far as the IRS is concerned. I took her as my research assistant because I felt that she could help me open doors, that things that I didn't understand she could kind of help me with. And so I had this whole trip planned out months in advance, this very detailed itinerary, including a meeting with Marconi's last surviving daughter from his second marriage, Princess Elettra. So we arrive in Rome the night before the Pope's funeral. The night before the Pope's funeral. And I'm thinking, oh man, everything is just shot. You know, I this is going to be the most worthless trip, but I had non-refundable tickets, you know, that whole thing. The rumor as we got on the plane in Seattle was that people arriving that evening would be asked to sleep on their planes because Rome was full, you know. So we arrive in Rome. The airport is empty. Customs guys are just, they have like nothing to do. They just wave us through. One guy was actually singing. Catch a cab. Cab is just there. There's no traffic on the way into Rome. The hotel is waiting for us. The room is fantastic. It was just idyllic. And Rome itself was very quiet. Vatican City was thronged, but Rome itself was very quiet. And actually kind of festive. It was really odd. It was very odd. But anyway, so we arrive, check in, and my daughter asks the concierge for a recommendation for dinner. And I swear the concierge that he got this little twinkle in his eye, because immediately he says, Da Sabatino, which is essentially Sabatino's. And it's a small family-style, very simple restaurant about 4 or 5 blocks from the Pantheon in Rome. But it's not a tourist place. It's very, very undiscovered. It's very simple, very, very nice spot. I recommend it. It has an outdoor area on the piazza, an outdoor terrace. So my daughter and I decide, okay, we're going to have dinner on the terrace. I mean, we're in Rome, why not? It's a little cool, but we decide we're going to do it. This is April. Or was it May? I can't remember. But anyway, the only other people, by the way, on the terrace were two priests who were drinking whiskey, free whiskey. The guy kept coming out pouring free whiskey, and this was good stuff, you know. These guys were so cool. These guys looked like they could have stepped off the set of The Exorcist, you know. There they were. I mean, it's just such a cool evening. It's just wonderful. About 3/4 of the way through dinner, there's two big guys walk into the piazza, walk into the terrace, and start walking around. And one guy comes back out of the restaurant. He's got this little American flag pin here, and I'd had some wine, and so I said to him, I said, you know, you got to be U.S. Secret Service. A little hesitation there, and he said, well, yes, I am. Conversation kind of died right then. He walked back into the restaurant. His supervisor comes out a few moments later. a very nice guy, sort of very sort of engaging guy. And he said to us, he said, you know, if you stick around for 10 more minutes, you're going to be surprised. So, of course, we paid and left, you know. We stuck around. And sure enough, about 5-10 minutes later, this caravan of cars comes screaming into the piazza. Two giant SUVs, Chevy Suburbans in Rome. In Rome, two giant Chevy Suburbans come screaming into the piazza, preceded by four Alfa Romeos and followed by four Alfa Romeos, the Italian police. The Italians do this better than anybody in the world. They come, you know, the klaxons are going, the cars come screaming into the piazza, the guys on the passenger side are have their doors open, looking at the rooftops. You know, it's like Mission Impossible 3, you know, it's just great. I loved it. The little boy in me was just applauding endlessly. And my daughter, who's totally into international politics and Alias and all this stuff, was like, wow, my dad is the coolest, you know. So these guys come screaming into the piazza, park very neatly on one side, and in come, I think it had to be about four Secret Service men, which is odd given who was following, but they come walking up the center of the restaurant there, and who is behind them but William Jefferson Clinton. Now, I don't care what your politics are, what you think about Bill Clinton. I really, you know, and I understand all that, but the man brings with him a shockwave of charisma. Truly, I fell in love with him. Anyway, he's coming down the center of this restaurant. I'm sitting here. My daughter is here. He's coming down here. Who is he looking at? Is he looking at me? Or is he looking at my daughter, who even then was 5'10", strawberry blonde hair, green eyes, drop-dead gorgeous? So he comes walking up, and only then, the way that only Bill Clinton can, he says, well, hi. I'd have shot him then, but for obvious reasons, I didn't. So he comes, he says, well, hi. And my daughter is just entranced. She goes, hi. And in they go. I offered him a cigar. He wouldn't take it. Now, you see, I do play both sides of the political fence. You understand that? So anyway, they go into the restaurant. The waiter at this restaurant is an absolutely charming guy. And he knows that my daughter's totally into this. And the Italians are into two things, especially above all else: kids and beauty. You know, I mean, truly, it's like the cult of children and the cult of beauty. He comes over to her, gives her a hug, and then he says to us, you know, you should think about getting dessert. But in a way that sort of suggested that something else was going to happen. We were getting code by now from everybody. You know, God is up there watching us. So we ordered a tiramisu to share. Another 5 minutes or so pass. Another caravan comes screaming into the piazza. No SUVs this time. Large black sedans, but preceded by the Italians and followed by the Italians. Again, very dramatic. And these guys do this so well. On the one side, they were parked on neat angled parking. And on the other side, suddenly there were these cars neatly angled, like fish bones. You know, it was just really quite beautiful. And again, the little boy in me was appreciating that. You know, I was like, wow, that's great. And some more guys come down the center of the restaurant. These were bigger and scarier looking. They had black leather. They looked like real tough guys. Followed by a guy I couldn't recognize at first. He's at a distance. He's kind of staggering a bit over the kind of cobblestones. Looked a little unsteady. He's wearing a gray suit, pompadour. To me, from a distance, he looked like a washed-up lounge singer. I mean, he really did. You know, like one too many Barry Manilows in the Holiday Inn at the corner, you know? And so he comes staggering up, and suddenly it was like the cover of Time magazine had just walked by our table. Here he was, Dioxin Boy himself, you know, the third president of the Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko. He comes walking by. He didn't even look at us. I mean, he just came walking by. It was all he could do, is just sort of keep going. So I just thought, how remarkable. There we were in Rome the night before the Pope's funeral, and these two guys were having a quiet dinner at a dive, picked no doubt by Bill Clinton. And we were the only people in the Western world, besides a couple of priests and 1,000 security men, who knew about it. You know, it was one of those absolutely magical little moments that when you're doing the research on the book can sometimes happen. And I thought at this point what I would do is sort of stop the so-called formal part of my talk and take questions, because that's actually my favorite part of the thing, and we can talk about anything except Devil in the White City. I'm only kidding about that. Yes, sir. Right. I don't do a lot of it because I think that memory is untrustworthy to begin with. Second generation memory is tremendously untrustworthy. I mean, I do try to find out who's got letters, who doesn't. My interview with Princess Electra was interesting, but not that valuable to me. More valuable actually was my interview with Marconi's grandson, who is a physicist in Munich, and that was actually a very interesting conversation, mainly because it confirmed things that I felt that I already knew. It was nice to have that sort of affirmation from a member of the family. But as a rule, what I much prefer is finding things that are of the moment. For example, in the case of Thunderstruck, I was very lucky to find literally thousands of pages of Scotland Yard documents, statements taken by detectives from various witnesses, not witnesses to the crime, but witnesses to the couple involved, to how they lived, to various aspects of the case, and also from the Department of Public Prosecutions, thousands of pages of depositions. That was really valuable. I never even knew they took depositions back then. So that's what I like, is having something of the time when details are fresh. Very interesting. Walter Dew wrote, he's the chief inspector who's involved in this case. Walter Dew initially during this manhunt and chase filed a number of very detailed reports with Scotland Yard, and then later wrote a memoir. And the memoir was very different than the initial reports filed with Scotland Yard. The memoir was written in the 1930s, so even with Dew, some of the details were fuzzy. So I much prefer that. One thing I found for this book was just absolutely invaluable. I was concerned about. It's one thing to write about Chicago, because as an American, we all sort of come to American cities and American history with certain constructs that are essentially valid. I just needed to sort of fill in the details by going back and kind of learning about the specifics of Chicago architecture and life. Dealing with Edwardian London was a lot different because I'm not English. You know, I don't have everything that an English schoolboy has. So it was kind of, that was sort of a challenge. How do you recreate Edwardian England? And one of the things that I found, I don't usually do a lot of web research. I find that you can sort of get really burned out on a lot of kind of crappy stuff. But there was one website, two websites actually, but one in particular that was incredibly valuable. It was Charles Booth's website. He was a reformer who back in the 1880s was really ticked off at the socialists, the big socialist movement back then. He was really ticked off at the socialists, Fabianists, because they were saying that there was so much poverty in London, and he did not believe that there was that much poverty in London. So he set out to prove them wrong and did a street-by-street survey. He had all these volunteers join him. He did a street-by-street survey in which they accompanied they accompanied cops on their beats, which was at the time were fairly small walking areas. They accompanied these agents for the school districts who tried to keep tabs on every student in every neighborhood in London. And he covered every single street in London and found, much to his surprise, that over 30% of London was deeply impoverished. In fact, he was the man who coined the word poverty line. He's the first man to use the term poverty line. Anyway, one of the beauties of this website is that, first of all, they have scanned everything in so it's searchable, but also they have photographed and have put them up on the website, his notebooks. So what was really wonderful was to find that there was a pivotal address. Again, it's Hilldrop Crescent, also Store Street, but Hilldrop Crescent is the pivotal address. And on three occasions, he walked through Hilldrop Crescent back in that era, in the 1890s and also in 1900, which was incredibly valuable because it's like it's almost as though I had my research assistant back in time communicating to me through this website. It was really kind of creepy in a way. It was wonderful. That's how I know that, you know, many of the houses had gilded cages in the front window with birds in them. That was sort of the motif in the middle class neighborhood that Hilldrop Crescent was. So it was really an amazingly powerful thing. That's the kind of thing I love. Other questions? Yes. Yeah, he says, how do you fill holes in the narrative? Fill holes in the narrative by moving on to the next paragraph. Because I only know their holes. You're not going to know their holes. Also, or just skipping white space, you know, and then, you know, so-and-so did such and such. I can spot holes. I mean, I know where the holes are, but they're irrelevant to the narrative because there's nothing there to fill them. You see what I mean? So you just move on to the next thing. So it seems seamless to you, but it's not really. It's sort of skipping. Yes. Yeah, I mean, she's asking a question about Kendall, and was there an aha moment in discovering an association he has with a very, very significant shipwreck? As you rightly point out, there were all these pivotal moments that he was involved in. I mean, this is a guy who led a life that Joseph Conrad could have written about. It's just incredible that one man could lead this life. And no, the answer is no. I didn't know anything about that shipwreck until I was probably about 6 months into the research when I started to focus on Kendall. And I was stunned. And then ultimately I wound up in Ottawa and I was looking through the Mercy. Somebody help me out with the term for shipwreck inquests. It's called we'll come back to it. But anyway, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages about that shipwreck, which is just fascinating to me, including various statements and biographies of Kendall, information about his past before the shipwreck, which was what I was after. So it was really, really, he's one of my favorite characters in the book. I love Captain Kendall. I wish I had been Captain Kendall. Well, except for that shipwreck. and except for the other things that happened to him. I mean, what an amazing guy. What an amazing guy. Yes. Truman Capote's book. I mean, I love In Cold Blood. In fact, I read it again just before I embarked on the research while I was doing the research for Devil in the White City. But yes, he actually had this relationship and talked to these guys. But make no mistake, that is what they call a nonfiction novel. I wish he had had footnotes because I would love to know where everything came from. It's one of the eternal mysteries. He claims that he only changed the ending. He only made up the ending. But that's the worst part of the book. You know, so I'm thinking there's a disconnect there. But no, what we've done is very, very different stuff. In my books, I'm trying to stick as closely as possible as I can to historical record. If you think that oh gosh, he's making it up, you need to just sort of check the footnotes. Like, for example, anything between quotes is not made up. It's from some document, a transcript, a letter, a memoir. I mean, I was reading through a part of this thing tonight, and I was briefly appalled because I thought, if anybody thinks this is made up, it's going to sound like it's really badly written. But it's not made up; it's the real deal. So that's why it reads the way it is. This is a short two-paragraph stretch. Don't let it put you off. But anyway, in The Devil in the White City, though, I did encounter one problem that I didn't encounter in any of my other books, and not in this one, and that is, you got those three murders that are the central murders in the thing. I mean, he killed a lot more people, but you got three murders. And I really felt that there needed to be some sort of sense of what happened in the course of those murders based on the available evidence. So I decided, okay, I got to take this approach. Now, I don't know how many of you watch court TV, but you know, if you tune into court TV in the midst of a trial, none of the testimony makes sense. It's like they're talking about the cost of a hamburger at Jack in the Box, and the trial is about an axe murder in Dubuque. You know, I mean, there's just these, you get this sort of one impressionistic sense of what's happening in the trial. But as anybody who's attended a criminal trial knows, the key thing, there are two key moments. In the beginning, when you have your opening arguments, prosecutor and defense attorney, and at the end, when you have your closing arguments, prosecutor and defense attorney. And that's when you take the available evidence and you make an argument based on that evidence. You put those pieces together. So I thought, okay, I'm going to take that stance. I'm going to do the prosecutor's approach here. But then I'm going to reveal my reasoning in the footnotes. That's why for each of those spots you will see a brief narrative saying what I was trying to do, and then you'll see specific footnotes citing the various bits of evidence. And that's what I felt like was appropriate for that one. This one, it wasn't necessary. There's so much stuff, you know. It was really kind of a cakewalk in some ways. Well, no, it's never a cakewalk. But anyway, the stuff is there. Do I see any relationship between the killer and the inspector in this book and Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment? No, not really. Not really. This is, I mean, I understand what you're getting at. There is that sort of element of coming together, you know, briefly. But I don't want to. Yeah. Is my book as good as Crime and Punishment? Definitely. I mean, you know. Dostoevsky's got nothing on me. Yes, sir. You mean Jack the Ripper?
Yeah.
Well. No, actually, I have to tell you that one thing that I briefly explored, I was just thinking, oh, wouldn't it be something? I just briefly explored, wouldn't it be something if Holmes, in fact, was Jack the Ripper? You know, he took a new identity because he kept, one of the stories he told was that he had an English background, you know, and that he was actually the son of an English lord and all this stuff. But there's nothing to substantiate that. Any evidence that Jack the Ripper came to New York and did those killings? No, not really. I mean, it's just, it's fascinating to speculate about, but there, you know, and that's what people did speculate about, but I certainly don't take it any further than that. Yeah, but, yeah. And the connection in the book, in this book, is that Inspector Dew was one of the investigators in the Jack the Ripper case and had the fortune or misfortune to be in on the discovery of Jack the Ripper's last and most severely mutilated victim, which sort of colored his kind of perceptions of murder ever since. I'll take one more question. Or maybe not. Yes. She says, it seems like these are jigsaw puzzles of all these little details tied together. And actually, you know, I don't think they're, well, I mean, I write the book, so I'm taking these pieces and telling them in chronological order, which is the most powerful piece. But it's interesting. What I'm counting on, see, when I read these books, I think I read them very differently than you guys do, because I wrote them. You know, I read them as pieces of information that are tied together. But I think the beauty of being a reader coming to a book, be it my book or a book by David McCulloch, is that your mind attaches them. Your mind puts these things together in a much more fluid, vibrant way than they actually are. You see what I mean? I mean, for example, the material that is between quotes, it's not dialogue, but I have people endlessly come up to me and say, oh, but that dialogue, you had to make that up. But it's not dialogue. It's fragments, it's things from letters and so forth. But that's the beauty of reading. People make the book come alive. I'm just trying to sort of shape that process of coming alive with little bits and pieces along the way. That's what I mean. The little bits of detail that and ignite a fire in your mind and kind of keep that fire going. That's what I try to do. The trick is, though, is when... So I have a passion for digression. I have a passion for digression. One of my great joys in writing books like this is that I like to just sort of go off on tangents. The trick, the key is when you write something like this, is to put all that stuff into the book for the rough draft and then rely on your trusted readers to help you pull it out. And my most trusted reader is my wife. She's a terrific natural editor and a great reader. And what always happens with when I'm done with the first pass, I give it to her. Now, this is something that has to evolve over time. It's initially was somewhat confrontational, now it's not. We made a lot of rules. I have to, for one thing, when I give her the manuscript and she reads it, I can't be in the house at the same time. She's either gone to a medical conference or I have to be out of the house going out to a reporting trip, a research trip, because I can't bear to see her reading my book, you know, the yawns, you know, the falling asleep on the couch with, you know. But that's true. I mean, it is very hard for me to watch somebody read my stuff. So we have worked out this system where I give her the manuscript, and she does what she does. She gives it back to me. Another rule is that she's not allowed to say anything to me as she hands it back. She has to have like a poker face. See, I'm giving you an insight into absolutely how neurotic I am. She has to give it back to me, the poker face, because I know that if she said, this is the best thing you've ever written, I would know she was lying. And if she said, this really stinks, I would also know that she was lying. I would hope she was lying. She gives it back to me, and she gives it back to me with these codes in the margins, like a little up arrow is very good. I know from experience, keep that at all costs. A little down arrow, I know from experience, it goes. Cut it. Unfortunately, a lot of good stuff that I think a lot of the guys in the audience would have loved in Devil in the White City wound up on the cutting room floor, like 20 pages about the construction of the auditorium building in Chicago. I loved it. My wife was like, this is a snooze. So she has a smiley face. That's very, very important. And she has a sad face with little tear tracks. And this is actually extremely important to me because when I'm doing the research for my books, things will move me, things will make me laugh, and I have learned from experience, I actually have to write in the margin, sad, funny, whatever the emotion is, because after 4 years, it's all dead. You know, you forget what was powerful. And so then seeing a smile and a sad face is an affirmation, oh, that's right, I was right, that was sad, that is happy. And then comes the worst part, well, one part, one problem is when there are like long stretches where there's nothing. Then it's like, oh my God, my own wife skipped. And then there's sort of the worst part, which is where she has these little receding series of Z's in the margin. And then I know she and I have to talk. But anyway, so that's essentially the process. And it's a long process of kind of winnowing details out of the book so that you have a distillation that is as tight as you can possibly get it. So anyway, I thank you all for coming. And if anybody wants me to deface a book, I'll be glad to do it. But if not, I understand. And the hell with you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for John Naisbitt, Jeff Shara, Les Claypool, Nick Bantock, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 9th, 2006.